On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. It's Artscape Weekend, and this is Maryland Morning. This morning, another installment of our Health Watch series with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Lena Wen. It's one thing to call gun violence in America an epidemic. It's another to actually treat it like a public health crisis and to employ scientific methods to shape policy and save lives. Lena Wen on the best way to stop the killing. Then, how about them O's, hon? Our sports guru Mark Hyman checks in to talk about the Birds' best start in almost 20 years. And a little serenade from the one and only Wyclef Jean.
Every time I make a run, girl, you turn around and cry. I ask myself, fog tomorrow high.
I told you it was little. I'll talk to Wyclef Jean before he kicks off Artscape tonight. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story. Nathan's got the local news. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Lena Wen is the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. She joins me again this morning for our monthly feature, Health Watch. Good morning, Doctor. Good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
So you've got a lot on your plate, and the purpose of this series is to get some of what's on your plate on people's minds. Let's talk first about gun violence. This has, of course, been on everybody's mind these last couple of weeks in particular. But even before the events in Baton Rouge and St. Paul and Dallas, there was a summit here in Baltimore about youth violence. You participated in that and helped host it. What's your take on the current approach to solving this horrible epidemic of gun violence?
People tend to see gun violence as a criminal justice issue. They see the person who is holding a gun and they say, oh, that's the person that we have to intervene on. We in public health see violence as a public health issue, not just as a criminal justice issue. And the reason is that violence spreads from person to person like a disease. There is a cure for violence. There's treatment for violence. There's also prevention as well. And in public health, it's all about the mindset. It can't just be about seeing someone as the perpetrator of violence without recognizing that they're also the victim of trauma and that we have to look even earlier, not just look at the person in that moment, but what it is that led them there. So can we, for example, reduce lead poisoning in our children in order to increase the opportunities? Can we give glasses to kids as we have through Vision to Baltimore? Can we do all of these types of interventions early in childhood to give our children every chance for success as a way to prevent violence, but also to increase opportunities later on in life?
So you're a medical scientist, and you're saying there are ways of dealing with this problem, treating it epidemiologically.
I see this in my medical practice. I see it in the ER that people are dying of gun violence. So there's no doubt to me that violence is a health issue because it impacts people's health and welfare and the well-being of their families. But we also know based on data that violence can be interrupted. Our Safe Streets model in Baltimore, for example, has resulted in hundreds of people's lives saved because our violence interrupters and outreach workers walk the streets of the city and stop violence where it's occurring. We also know from studies that even something as early on as nurses and social workers visiting pregnant moms, that intervention actually reduces the likelihood of that child later being involved in violent activities. And so this is not something that only I'm saying. It's something that we recognize across the country that, you know, there are so few medical diseases that have a complete cure. There is a cure for violence, and we can do something about it. We just have to have the political will to do it, and we have to have everyone change their mindset to think about violence as a preventable, curable disease.
And when you think about the scientific evidence that suggests certain policies are going to work more effectively than others, there's, of course, a renewed discussion about gun regulation and some people call it gun control, in the wake of the violence in the last couple of weeks. But of course, research into it, the amount of data that you and other scientists have to work with is limited right now by federal law.
Federal funding does not allow for research into gun violence. That's crazy. If there are 30,000 people per year who are dying of any other illness, we would absolutely have research into it. And so this is one of those things that doesn't make sense. And Congress has an opportunity to act upon it and rectify the wrongs of our past.
There are even gag orders for physicians when they're dealing with patients who are victims of gun violence. How does that work? And that seems like an easy enough one to get rid of. Just, in other words, are doctors prevented from speaking to their patients about the circumstances under which they've been shot?
I remember seeing 2-year-old, 3-year-old kids experimenting with guns and injuring themselves and their family members, even dying from these injuries. I mean, gun safety seems to be something that is a nonpartisan issue. We all agree with safety for our children. In Maryland, we do not have a gag order, thankfully, for physicians. But there are other states, including Florida, where physicians cannot even ask about gun safety in the home. And that should be a free speech issue, but it also is directly interfering with the care of our patients. And it's interfering with our ability to protect our patients. And so another one of those things that does not make sense and that we really must change.
Let's also talk about Zika. More than 30 cases confirmed here in Maryland. We've got athletes from Maryland and around the world headed to Rio de Janeiro in about a month for the Olympics. There's lots of concerns about that. Several athletes have publicly declared they're not going. As a physician, what do you recommend people do to prevent possible infection with the Zika virus?
Three important things. The first is if you are a pregnant woman, do not travel to places where there is active Zika transmission ongoing. So there are over 60 countries that have active Zika, and you can look on the CDC website, cdc.gov, and find out where those countries are. Do not travel there because of the risk of Zika is not to the average person, it is to the pregnant woman, and because of the link with birth defects in the unborn child. Second, if you are the male partner of a pregnant woman, make sure to abstain from sex or use condoms every time if you end up traveling to an area with active Zika ongoing. Third is that there's something all of us can do today. Zika could come to Baltimore, but also there are other diseases that mosquitoes carry as well. Remember that mosquitoes breed in standing water. So take the time today, look in your backyard. It's raining outside. It's very hot. We're declaring cold red. We know that that it's hot weather, summer season. Look outside and make sure that you get rid of every container that could have standing water. So even a small bottle cap, but certainly pet dishes and garbage cans and flower pots, make sure that all those are dumped and or covered. Make sure that your trash cans, for example, are covered, because prevention is the best medicine. When there is no cure, there is no vaccine. You can protect yourself today.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the health commissioner of Baltimore City. It's Health Watch here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. You gave some testimony to the Democratic Platform Committee, and you wrote an op-ed that just appeared Wednesday, I guess, in the publication called The Hill. You talked about Zika, you talked about gun violence, and you talked about opioids. This is, of course, a thing that you and I have talked about on this segment many times. It's a disease, and you've been the first to make that point, or one of the many to make that point. But there's, like Zika, it's difficult, to get Congress to act in terms of legislation that can move the needle forward.
I have never seen so many pieces of legislation in front of the U.S. Congress that directly impact public health as has been in the last couple of weeks, that there's been this unprecedented opportunity for Congress to actually be a public health Congress. And this is what I wrote the op-ed on, that we can really address addiction as a disease and put full funding behind it. That has not happened. We can understand that Zika is a crisis in slow motion, and we can really prevent this from affecting generations of our kids that are not yet born. And we have not done that. We can understand gun violence as something that is killing over 30,000 people every year, that we can prevent and save those lives. And we have not done that. So Congress has once again failed us. But my testimony to the Democratic National to the Democratic National Committee platform drafting is to talk about how our national platform needs to address these issues. Congress didn't address it this session. They have an opportunity to next time. But also, we have to view these issues as a public health priority. We have to talk about addiction as a disease. We have to get mental health parity. We have to not just do whack-a-mole emergencies every time a public health issue comes up, like Zika, but we have to have full funding for that. And critically, we need to invest in health, because health is the basis for everything else. It's not just looking at criminal justice and education, but also understanding that health is foundational to everything.
The amount of money that the president has called for to combat the Zika virus, for example, there was a bill a couple of weeks ago, three weeks ago, I guess by now, that failed in the Senate because they added on, Republicans added on a Planned Parenthood dimension to this bill. It's known in the trade as a poison pill. So the inaction really is quite stunning, given the fact that Zika is not going away, and the longer we wait to address it, the harder it's going to be.
And it's something that literally is a crisis in slow motion. We know that this is going to happen. Brazil has already over 1,600 babies that were born with this severe birth defect directly linked to Zika. How many babies will we find it acceptable in our country, especially because Zika is a disease of poverty and disproportionately affects areas like Baltimore City that already experience the worst health disparities? We're the ones who may not have air conditioning, prenatal care, air doors and window screens. I mean, we're going to be the most affected. How many babies will we find that to be acceptable? And when we saw this coming, so we see this as a health issue, we see this as a civil rights issue, and it's despicable considering that there's something that we can do today by Congress not giving us full funding for Zika. As you said, Tom, it's distracting from our other key priorities. There are more people dying from overdose in our city than from homicide. We really should be treating that as well. Many other diseases and concerns in our city that we should be doing, but it is something that we require all hands on deck, that all of us have to work on together, but we really need funding from a federal government in order to address it.
We got 20 seconds left. Yesterday, you declared a code red here in Baltimore. It's been hot for the past, 4 or 5 weeks. Just remind folks what folks need to do when the heat gets intense.
Hot weather can be deadly. Make sure that you stay hydrated. Don't drink alcohol, but drink water and other fluids to stay hydrated. Stay indoors when possible in air-conditioned spaces. When possible, limit your time outside. Watch out for standing water because there are mosquitoes all around. And very importantly, do not leave your kids or your pets inside a contained space like a car. The car heats up many degrees faster than the outside air. And every year we have rescued pets and children, and I've actually seen kids and pets die as well. So never leave your kids and pets inside a car and drink lots of water.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is Baltimore City's health commissioner. She joins us here on Maryland Morning every month for our Health Watch series. Dr. Nguyen, keep up the good work. Many thanks. We'll see you next time.
Nice to see you, Tom. Thank you.
Coming up after a break for the news, sports guru Mark Hyman on whether the Orioles can keep up their good work in the second half of the season. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Something magic happens every time you go. You make the magic happen, the magic of Orioles baseball. When the game is close and the O's are hot, there's a thundering roar from 34 to give it all they've got. And you never know who's gonna hear the call. There's a different start. That's the magic of Orioles baseball.
Orioles magic, feel it happen. Orioles magic, feel it happen. O-R-I-O.
The
Baltimore Orioles went into the All-Star break at the top of the American League East, two games ahead of the Boston Red Sox. Five birds went to the All-Star game this week, and they've managed to have this great season so far, despite some less than stellar performances by the starting rotation. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Our resident sports guy, Mark Hyman, is part of the Maryland Morning starting rotation. He joins me in Studio A. He's on the faculty of George Washington University and the author of several books, the latest of which is called Concussions and Our Kids. Morning, Mark.
Good morning, Tom.
So, you know, after the couple of weeks that the United States has had, that the world has had with the shootings in Baton Rouge and Falcon Heights and Dallas, and then, you know, this morning the news of this horrible apparent terrorist attack in Nice, France. This perhaps is the kind of moment we remind ourselves why we like sports, why we pay attention to this. I mean, it is, if nothing else, a balm to the reality that we face in every other aspect.
Yeah, I mean, sports really is pure escapism. You know, that's why we go out to the ballpark, because at the end of the day, you know, no matter how passionate we may be about what we see on the field, it really doesn't matter that much. And, you know, I think that's the appeal. That's the great value of sports, I think.
Yeah, and the Orioles have given us an awful lot to cheer about this year. This first half, I guess, probably the best first half that they've had in nearly 20 years. I think 1998 maybe was something that was similar. We always talk about the very first cliche in baseball, that you can't win without pitching.
Yeah.
Well, except we are.
That was, I think, in 1869, they were probably saying that, you know, good pitching beats good hitting, you know, every time. But just to back up for a second, it is, in fact, the Orioles' best start at the All-Star break since 1997. They're 51-36, 15 games over 500. Interestingly, I think that it's not the best team since 1997. I think there are weaknesses on this team that are significant and that they've got to address if they're going to advance to the postseason. But, you know, you got to hand a lot to Buck Showalter, who I think has done the most with a team that has some pretty significant weaknesses, as I say.
Do you think maybe the rest of the league has some pretty significant weaknesses too? I mean, it is a competition, and every year is different.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, we tend to focus, obsess really about, you know, our team and what we do well and what we don't do well. But, you know, in Boston, in Toronto, they're talking about the same things. They're wondering why their starting pitching isn't as good and how they can improve their lineup. So, yes, every team in the division, there are no perfect teams in baseball this year, particularly in the AL East. But the Orioles have, I think, some real issues to deal with in the second half.
They have some really great things going on first. Let's talk about the issues first, however.
Okay.
You know, starting pitching is a problem. I mean, the rotation that we have has just simply not delivered the goods by any means.
And this is not a great surprise. I think when I was here in April, we were talking about this issue, that the starting pitching, you know, Chris Tillman, who is nominally the ace of the Orioles' starting rotation, we were hopeful that he'd have a bounce back year after a pretty mediocre year last year. And he has had that. He's 12-2 at the break. Look, the Orioles record for victories in a season is 25. That's the Orioles' franchise record. You know, at the pace he's at, he could win 21 or 22. But beyond Chris Tillman, they've been, you know, very, very inconsistent, and that's charitable. They've got a couple of rookies, or have had a couple of rookies in the rotation who've pitched like rookies. Ubaldo Jimenez, who they signed several years ago for $14 million a year, you know, he's pitched, you know, he pitched horribly when he arrived. He has not really gotten any better. So there really are no... They need help. They need, you know, I don't think that the five pitchers they have in their rotation now are really the answer going forward.
I mean, of course, baseball is a game of odds. It's a game of, you know, probability. Ubaldo Jimenez started the All-Star game a few years ago. I mean, this was a major pitcher. And so to pay him 13, 14 million bucks a year sort of makes sense, right? And then he shows up and... he is not the pitcher that he was a few years ago.
Well, you know, it underscores how, you know, how
much
of an... And by
the way, neither are you or I. We are not the pitchers we were a few years ago.
Nor am I worth $14 million a year. but it does underscore how, you know, the process of player evaluation in baseball is more of an art than a science. You know, the Orioles have made some bad mistakes in terms of evaluating pitching talent, and they've traded away. So, or allowed to get away some pitchers who would have been extremely helpful to them right now. And, of course, you know, the best example is Jake Arrieta, who now pitches for the Cubs and won the Cy Young Award last year in the National League. That's the award for the best pitcher in the league. And, you know, the Orioles several years ago, just he wasn't making progress. You know, he had come up through the Orioles minor leagues, and they decided to trade him away for a veteran pitcher who they thought could help them in the short term. They would love to have him now. There are several other examples of pitchers who are pitching in the major leagues productively and were property of the Orioles several years ago and are not playing for the Orioles now.
So how do the Orioles get some good pitching? We've got to trade somebody away. So who's that? I mean, we have a lot of really good players. Are any of them, you know, in danger of being on the chopping block?
Well, you know, the Orioles have a couple of options. None of them are great. I mean, for one thing, they don't have a lot of talent in their minor league system right now that would be attractive to teams that are looking to trade their pitching to the Orioles. That's an obstacle. And every team, you know, every team in contention or teams that believe they're going to be in contention right now are looking to acquire starting pitching. So the Orioles are competing against a number of teams that are also looking for the same thing. You know, I think the options, the best options for the Orioles right now are to, you know, perhaps look at a pitcher who's on the team right now, Dylan Bundy, who was a number one draft choice for the Orioles a couple of years ago, is pitching in the bullpen now, but has pitched very effectively and would not surprise me to see him in the starting rotation at some point in the second half. There are pitchers out there that that are available in trade, and you know, the Orioles may make a run at, you know, Matt Moore of the Tampa Bay Rays or a Drew Pomeranz for the Padres. But as I say, I just don't think they have enough talent to make those deals right now.
On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Our sports guru, Mark Hyman, joins me. We're talking a little O's, hon. Going away from pitching and onto the other side, onto the offensive side, if pitching beats hitting every time, I don't know. The Orioles are sort of making mincemeat out of that little cliche. The Baltimore Orioles broke the record for the team hitting the most home runs in the month of June. The guy who's hitting more home runs than any other player in Major League Baseball, Mark Trumbo, is on our team. We are smashing it out of the park with some regularity.
Well, the Orioles are winning a lot of, you know, 9-8 games this year, and Mark Trumbo certainly is a part of the reason for that. And, you know, Mark Trumbo is an example of kind of the flip side of what we were talking about. The Orioles have made a number of deals, you know, brought talent to the team in trades and free agent signings that have really helped them. And they've acquired players that other teams didn't want. So I think we need to be fair and acknowledge that. Mark Trumbo, the Orioles acquired in a trade from the Seattle Mariners in the offseason for, you know, players who are really, you know, not in their future. And Mark Trumbo's hit 28 home runs at the break, leading Major League Baseball in home runs. And he's on his way to a career season. His career best is 34 home runs. So that was a fantastic acquisition, and all credit to the Orioles for that. They also picked up a very interesting player who's turned out to be important to them, Hyun-Soo Kim, the Korean ball player who is playing left field in spring training.
Yeah, we talked about him in spring training. He was terrible, and Showalter wanted to bring him, put him down to the minors, and he had some clause in his contract or something that said he didn't have to go if he didn't want to, and he actually stood up to the management and said, no, I'm not going.
It's really an interesting story because, you know, first of all, you know, they signed him from Korea. They really had not that great an idea. Very difficult to evaluate a player from Korea who's playing against other, you know, Korean ball players. So they had very little sense, or not as great a sense as I'm sure they would have liked, as to how good he was going to be. And in spring training, he showed nothing. He could not catch up to the fastball. He was not impressive defensively. And as you say, Buck Showalter wanted to demote him. But in his contract, he had the right to refuse a demotion. If the Orioles wanted to get him off the team, they had to release him. And Kim, to his credit, refused that demotion. And he was exactly right because he's made some adjustments at the plate. He's hitting 329. So, you know, it's very the whole you know, international players are very interesting. There are only four or five Korean players in the major leagues right now, and they have to make tremendous cultural adjustments in order to succeed here. And Kim just needed a little bit more time.
Yeah, and he's gotten it, and he's making the best of it. You know, at the beginning of the season, we talked about, you know, paying players like Chris Davis as much as $161 million a year over a multi-year contract. And it just seems like an awful lot of money. On the other hand, the Orioles perhaps have never been as fun to watch in the last, you know, 20 years. I mean, they are just, it's a gas watching them play.
Yeah, it's great. Great fun to go out to the ballpark this year, for sure.
By the way, there's a little tidbit you told me about the other day, that ESPN has just auctioned off the right to attend an Orioles game with Tim Kirchin, who is a former colleague of yours at the Baltimore Sun. He's got a new book out. We're going to read that book and talk to Tim about it at some point. But he's a reporter for ESPN, and the winning bid was nearly $6,200 to go to the game with Tim Kirchin.
Amazing. Go to a game with a sports writer for $6,200.
Well, the next time you and I go to a game, I got to tell you, I ain't paying that.
Yeah, I'll only take checks, Tom.
Let's talk a little bit about the Olympics that start on the 5th of August. A bunch of Marylanders going, and of course, the most, you know, highlight name is Michael Phelps, but a bunch of other folks going either for the first time or returning.
Yeah, I wanted to mention some of the Marylanders who are going to be competing in Rio. Christina Epps, who's actually featured in The Sun this morning, a triple jumper from Coppin State.
First athlete from Coppin State to go to the Olympics. That's a terrific story.
So we are rooting for Christina Epps for sure. Some others who are fairly high-profile athletes from Maryland, Matt Centrowitz from Broadneck High School in Annapolis, who won the 1,500 meters in the Olympic trials in Eugene, Oregon last week. He was on the Olympic team and ran in the 1,500 meters in London in 2012. And finished fourth. And
by like microseconds.
Oh, my God.
Right?
I think it was 0.04 seconds from winning a bronze medal. But he will be a medal favorite and perhaps the gold. He's fantastic. Katie Ledecky, of course, we know the swimmer.
She was a gold medalist last time in
from
London.
From Bethesda, yeah. And she's
going to
be very
strong. And a joy
to watch.
Gosh, you just love it when she gets in the pool. What
she's
a
got
great kid.
A lot of enthusiasm. She's she's a lot of fun to watch. Chase Kalish, who is kind of the unofficial.
Another swimmer.
Mm-hmm. Another swimmer from Bel Air and the unofficial protege of Michael Phelps, who will be a medal contender for sure. I wanted to mention Tatiana McFadden.
She's the Paralympian, yeah.
She is a Paralympian wheelchair athlete, has won multiple marathons around the world. She has the possibility of winning 7 gold medals in Rio, which is fantastic. She's from Clarksville and, you know, flies a little bit under the radar around here, but fantastic athlete.
Yeah, 7 gold medals. That's Phelpsian. And speaking of Mr. Phelps, what do you think? His fifth outing at the Olympics, but he's still favored to win a couple of events at least.
Yeah, he could win, you know, as many as 3 individual medals, and he's going to be swimming, you know, in a couple of medleys. So, you know, he could win 5 gold medals again. He's already got, 22 Olympic medals and I think 18 gold. So it is the 5th Olympic Games for him. And interestingly, he has never participated in opening ceremonies in an Olympics in the first 4 that he competed in.
And I guess the reason for that is that swimming's usually the second half of the games, and he's still training during the beginning, right? Is that right, or is he just?
No, I think that's a big
part
of it.
He's just not interested in walking around the stage.
Yeah, I think athletes who are competing in the later stages of the games are. They don't want to arrive, you know, 10 days before they're competing because they want to be at their absolute peak when their event comes around. So he's never marched with the U.S. team in the opening ceremonies. He's talking about doing that this time, and he and others have raised the possibility that he might be the flag bearer for the United States this time, which would be a tremendous honor for him. And you know,
it kind of makes a lot of sense for the U.S. Olympic team, too. I mean, you know, he's the guy that has won all these medals. I mean, these golds. I mean, that would be something.
I think it would be a nice honor for him in a way to cap off his career. He's not competing in the sixth game. I'm pretty confident of that. Yeah. This will be his last Olympic Games.
A couple of real quick things before we finish up. Golf is back in the Olympic Games for the first time since 1904, but there are a bunch of folks not playing in it because they're concerned about their health.
Yeah, the Zika virus has become a very significant factor in a couple of sports. And interestingly, in golf, golf has not been an Olympic sport since 1904. There was a major effort made to include it this time. And because of Zika, the four top players, the four top golfers in the world are not going to Rio. And that's really a shame. It's going to put a real cloud over the golf competition.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see how all this pans out. Of course, there are all sorts of people thinking, you know, Rio's not going to be ready. And that's, again, a narrative that we hear a lot of times. But we'll just see how it goes. And we will certainly cover it here on Maryland Morning with you and others. So thanks so much. Good to see you.
Great.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Tom.
Mark Hyman is on the faculty of George Washington University, and he's the author of several books, the latest of which is called Concussions and Our Kids. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. After a break for the news, Wycliffe Jean joins me in advance of his show at Artscape tonight.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Every time I make a run, girl, you turn around and cry. I ask myself why. See, you must understand, I can't work a 9 to 5, so I'll be gone. Till November.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Artscape weekend. In about an hour or so, the largest free arts festival in the country kicks off. This year, Artscape celebrates its 35th anniversary, and festival organizers expect hundreds of thousands of folks to hit the streets to take in lots of music, art, theater, and fashion. You can count on a lot of those folks coming out to catch a performance by Grammy Award-winning artist Wycliffe Jean, who is headlining opening night tonight. Wycliffe got his start with the hip-hop group The Fugees, and he has had a long and fascinating career. He's worked with the likes of Beyoncé and Shakira. He even ran for president of his native country, Haiti, back in 2010. His upcoming album, Carnival 3, comes out later this year. Wycliffe Jean joins me on the phone. Welcome. How you doing?
Every time I make a run, girl, you turn around and cry. I ask myself, Baltimore, Ohio.
Well, I can tell you that you've already got our producer, Bridget Armstrong, in tears, so you're off to a really good start. The show tonight will be anticlimactic, I'm sure. So many things about your work is fascinating to me. You've worked with everybody from, you know, Destiny's Child to Whitney Houston to Mick Jagger, Paul Simon. I mean, what do you think it is about your work and your musical personality that attracts artists from such a wide spectrum to want to work with you?
Well, everybody has somebody that they idolize, right? So for me, it's always been Quincy Jones, right? So for me, like, the genesis of music is based on fusion, right? So being a student of fusion and understanding jazz at a young age and understanding hip-hop at a very young age, it's just a natural love for it. It allows me to see, you know, music as a feeling opposed to a genre, or this is country, this is rap, this is reggae, right? I see it as a feeling, you know what I mean?
Yeah. The single that you have from the new album called Carnival Volume 3, Road to Clefication. Clefication, I think in part has to mean this incredible array of, it's almost sound design elements that you use in the tunes that you write.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the term clefication came from a DJ by the name of Avicii. And, you know, they're, like, younger than me, but I'm, like, the human application to music. So they mostly use the laptops, you feel me?
Yeah.
So, like, I play all the instruments and all of that. So whenever they want me to, like, add some sauce to what they do, they'd be like, yo, Unc, man, give us some of that clefication, you know?
Meaning real instruments, right?
Yeah. So it's just so funny because we're in a new generation. Two records we had just came out. One's called My Girl, and the other's called Hendrix. Hendrix had developed a new sound called Acoustic Trap, and that record I tributed, like, to Jimi Hendrix. When we was in the trap in the hood, you know, the devil had two cards out. He was like, choose music or choose drugs, you know? And I chose music. Thank God I was practicing Jimi Hendrix in the basement, because that kept me away from what got my cousins locked up.
I chose music, my homies chose, yeah. Some of my ballers chose it in me, yeah. Cuz was on the block when the gang bang. Funeral parlors making all the change.
Yeah. When my cousin got his first tech, I was playing Jimi Hendrix in the basement. All I wanted to be was a rock star, and all he wanted to be was an Escobar.
You got into the political realm, you know, hook, line, and sinker. I mean, you ran for president of Haiti. Do you still, you know, aspire to political position at some point in the future?
The idea of, like, running for president of a country, right, and you being an artist, think about it for 1 second. It's pretty insane, right? Because what happens is you have people who spend their entire life that are studying poli-sci, right? And the whole thing is they're supposed to be within these positions, right? But we're in situations where the artists have to step up. The musicians have to step up, right? Because the system that was set up to protect us at times no longer do that. So I ran for president of Haiti because I knew that the corporate interests would not be beneficial to the people. I knew that the trade policies would not be beneficial for the people. The lesson that I definitely learned from that was, in moving forward, I definitely will continue my social obligations, but that's for the world. Like, whether if it's for Haiti, whether if it's Tibetan freedom, Fuji's is short for refugees. We've constantly fought for that. But after the experience that I had in Haiti, I've realized, right, to move third world islands forward, or third world countries, it's going to take social entrepreneurship, right? So you're going to need, like, big banks who so-called have a social responsibility and an interest to start investing in human capital in these different ghettos and these different slums, you know? And that's not just for Haiti, brother, man. That's for the, that's for America, that's for Africa, that's for Brazil. We, in America, we send money back home to make sure that they're better, right? So we can also challenge these institutions to use their social obligation to actually invest in the youth of these different countries.
What are your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement and the current climate of mistrust and anger between communities of color and law enforcement?
I really want people to understand, right, because I have law enforcement in my family, right, and even I have been subject to the police stopping me, and the way that they talk to me, my brother, it's insulting, right?
Because, and it's an experience that black men have been having in this country for a long, long time.
You have to understand, the majority of police is good. Is it really a police problem, or is it really an institution problem, right? And I think the problem starts off with institution, because with an institution, we have courts set up, right? And we have judges set up, correct? We have lawyers set up, and we have laws set up, right? Why is there always a loophole? So when wrong is done on behalf of the men in blue, they just walk as if it's normal, right? This is not a now time. It's been happening since the days of lynching, right? Remember one time, it just looked like lynching was just normal to the public. You understand?
Sure.
So what happens now is because of so many executions and so many law enforcement not being held accountable through the institutions that we vote for and we put in place, right, it almost seems like normalcy. We do believe in respect, and we do believe in equal rights and justice, right? So the actual idea of the Black Lives Movement is something that I will always support naturally, right? I have a song, right? I say, if your life matter, his life matter, her life matter, then why can't Black Lives Matter? You know what I'm saying to you?
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Well, Wycliffe John, it's really great talking to you, and look forward to hearing you play your job tonight, and, you know, all the best to you. Thanks so much.
Okay, bring your dancing shoes, baby.
Wyclef Jean headlines the opening night at Artscape tonight at 7:30 on the BGE main stage at MICA. The 35th anniversary edition of Artscape gets underway officially in about a little more than an hour. We've got a link to the app and to the complete schedule at WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill, with production assistance from Lauren Ferguson. Shane Raphael is our intern. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday morning on Maryland Morning, a conversation about the effects that cuts in funding in transitional housing are having. We'll also have a preview of the Republican Convention, which gets underway on Monday, and a review of the Contemporary American Theater Festival with our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor is up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great time at Artscape, and have a great weekend.